This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, hello, and welcome, or should I say welcome back, to the Independent Football Podcast. It is Tuesday the 23rd of April. I am your temporary host, Jack Pitbrook, in the absence of editor lead legend, Ed Mallion. I'm joined today by chief football writer, Miguel Delaney. Say hello, Miguel.
Hello.
Chief sports writer, Jonathan Liu. Say hello, Jonathan.
Hi. Happy St. George's Day.
Happy St. George's Day to you too. How are you finding it? Are you enjoying it?
Yeah. I mean, I feel more patriotic today. I feel proud of my country and everything it's done, good and bad. It's a day of celebration.
Which sportsman's St. George's Day tweets have you felt most inspired by?
Obviously, Jack Wilshere's.
Yeah, Jack Wilshere. I'm going to go. My two favourite sportsmen on St. George's Day are Jack Wilshere and Michael Vaughan, for their reliably pro England takes.
Well, didn't Wilshere have one about St. George's Day being taken away or something like that?
He said that being English is something that no one can ever take away from you.
Oh.
Which is what?
Unless you're Shamina Begum.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
we will not have. If you're listening, you can turn off now because we won't have a joke better than that for the rest of the podcast. But away from St. George's Day, tomorrow is an even bigger day in English national life. It is the title deciding Manchester Derby.
Yeah.
Manchester City, Manchester United at Old Trafford. Miguel, you know more about this than anyone. What's going to happen?
I think City will win quite easily. United are a shambles at the moment. I mean, 30% of me is looking at there, well, you know, big game and all, their pride has been hurt. And sometimes you do get responses in situations like this. But there's a lot of problems with United at the moment, as we saw on Saturday, or on Sunday, sorry, against Everton. And they go an awful lot deeper. I mean, I did a piece for the site today, which, of course, click on www.independent.co.uk/sport. Where's the football? Sport.
Oh, I think it's just slash football.
Probably should know that. You just tweet out a link that was handier than knowing.
Yeah. Bit.ly. What happened to that?
But anyway. I think there's a tapestry of issues wrong with United at the moment, which starts off with basically that run was unsustainable. Solskjaer is worried about the fitness of the team. And I think that is a legitimate issue, although some are questioning whether his own approach has played into the fitness team, because I've seen a lot of doubt about that mid-season trip they had to Dubai, and that has also fed into some doubts from some players about Solskjaer's tactical approach. But even that has to be put in the context of the fact that a lot of players know their future at the club is in doubt. So it's basically a mess, and on top of everything else, you have one of the biggest clubs in the world entrusting one of the most important periods in their recent history to a manager whose only success comes in the league ranked 23 in the UEFA coefficients, just ahead of the Kazakhstani league. So
you could scarcely have offered a bigger gift to City than this scenario. United kind of imploding. I don't think it's too strong a word. United imploding. The Champions League, obviously they wouldn't have wanted to get knocked out of the Champions League, but now essentially they don't have the quadruple to play for. That pressure is off them. This is the competition that they can focus on. And you know, you couldn't really have crafted better circumstances for City in which to face this derby.
Yeah.
What I would say is that maybe a couple of months ago, a lot of us didn't expect City to have to win this derby, and that's a credit to Liverpool that they've managed to make City win this.
The only slight wrinkle I'd say with that is maybe it would have been better for City to play them on Sunday rather than after the Everton game, because the Everton game was so bad. They got them just after Barcelona, because the Everton game was so bad. I mean, Barcelona was always kind of, they could explain it away, because it's Barca, even though that game was like humiliating in many ways. But the Everton game was so bad that like they have to, the player, for their own personal pride, they have to do something now. So there is that pressure.
There's been a lot written about how the Goodison Park game was like as bad as anything under Mourinho, and an embarrassing performance from all the players. Do you agree with that? And do you think that they're so bad now, United, that they're past the point the players will react? Do you think that like there's the possibility here for a sort of proud Manchester United performance of the players responding to that?
I think it is individually worse than any Mourinho. Like Mourinho, the problem with Mourinho is something more attritional, longer term. And like there were so many games like that were a grind. They did lose 4-0 to Chelsea, but that was against a really good Chelsea who won the title that season. And it was a different situation, whereas this was against an Everton who themselves are kind of all over the place. And just the performance was so just lax. What was the second question? Sorry.
What I did say is, do you think the players are capable of a response? And also, like added on to that, do you think the players have given up on Solskjaer?
I don't think they've given up. No. Well, I think more the greater problem there is that Solskjaer essentially knows now that a lot of these players aren't up to it, and I think that creates just a different dynamic. Like the chemistry of the United dressing room has greatly changed since his first 2 months, where basically him just coming in and not being Mourinho and having a bit of positivity created quite a singular happy place. But that was obviously unsustainable, and now we're seeing the flip side of that. And just when so many players are about to go or in doubt, it just means that. It's not necessarily a case of giving up on Solskjaer. It just means that group knows they're not going to be there. I mean, from a few things, like first of all, the Spanish group, which is Valencia, Rojo, Herrera, Mata, De Gea, that's set to be broken up in the summer, and they're a highly influential group in the dressing room. Then you have this bizarre situation where, because United have been so badly run in terms of recruitment and squad structure, basically all the players they want to keep are in situations where it's amenable for them to kind of maneuver their way out of the club, or they want to go, Pogba, De Gea, and Rashford even. And then the players they'd like to get rid of or have such contracts, that's actually very, very difficult to get rid of them. So even though Solskjaer has been given a kind of a mandate for a clear out in the summer, that's actually going to be difficult to do.
Yeah, I was thinking about this the other day, and what we've always compared this to in the last few months is Ole Gunnar Di Matteo, as in, he's got the job because the other guy was so unpopular, AVB, sorry, was so unpopular with the players. They needed to save their season. They needed to qualify for the top four. They needed to get back. They had a chance of winning the Champions League or the FA Cup, which is something that people were talking about with him fairly recently. And he's the guy to kind of put the players back in charge and put smiles back on faces and get everyone going again. But in the last few days, I started to think that what if it's not Ole Gunnar Di Matteo, but actually Ole Gunnar Sherwood, as in another guy who replaced AVB because AVB was so unpopular and the players all hated him, and who kind of started up trying to cheer people up. But pretty quickly under Sherwood, it just became, oh, these players are useless, lazy tossers, and we have to get rid of them all, have to bring in the new generation of young players because these guys are no good. Now, of course, Sherwood was proven completely wrong there, but Sherwood did basically go to war with the senior players incredibly quickly at Spurs. And it's funny how soon like this dynamic has changed for Solskjaer. And I just wonder if there's going to be, like, is he really going to win this battle? Is he really going to take on and defeat the Manchester United senior players?
Well, the thing about Di Matteo is that they had trophies to play for, and trophies will really focus a player's mind because there's a legacy there to be played for. And Di Matteo, I don't think was given the job on a permanent basis until after the end of the season. Is that right?
It was after they won the Champions League.
After they won the Champions League.
Because you remember that kind of fairly pathetic scene where he goes up to Abramovich as he's going up for the trophy. Now, understandable scene to be fair, but it's I won it! And like, you know.
And in hindsight, you know, Abramovich says like, nah, you didn't. that's the story that gets told. But for the Chelsea players, they knew that they could kind of crescendo to the peak. They could crescendo to the end of the season, knowing that there was a clean slate coming over the summer.
Also, that was a Chelsea team that had just 2 years beforehand won a title, so there was an element and been so successful for a long period. So there's an element of just there was a certain standard in the squad. That is not the case with this Manchester United, which is they just don't have that baseline level of competitiveness or success.
And if you're a player who suspects or maybe suspects they may be on their way out or maybe wants to leave, what is going to be the thing that wrecks that for you? It's going to be an injury. If you get a long-term injury, it's not sort of not missing out on the top four. It's not making the top four. It's, you know, maybe going in for a challenge and, you know, getting coming out on the wrong side of it, and you ruin your summer move. And that's potentially what's leading to these really kind of depressed levels of motivation in the squad.
Yeah. Sorry, go on, Joe.
To talk specifics, which United players is Solskjaer really targeting here, and do you think they will be, which of those do you think will still be here next season?
Weirdly, actually, I have a suspicion some of his comments might have been towards Pogba, but Pogba would be one of the players he wants to get rid of, if you know what I mean. Obviously, Smalling and Jones have been given new contracts, so it's not them. Valencia's going to go.
Shaw?
I think Shaw is actually relatively safe because he's young, and there is maybe potential there. Even though Mourinho wasn't always willing to see it. I think a lot of the midfield.
Fred, you give another season to Fred?
I actually would. I think he's a bit of a stranger in the sense that he's come to a new team. There's always that adaptation period. And even though he's made some calamitous errors, there's actually been the look of a player sometimes, and you'd give him a bit more leeway than players that have been there for 4 or 5 years and done little.
Yeah, he's shown enough.
I think Solskjaer wants Lukaku. I mean, it's interesting, there's been a lot of leaks about Lukaku at the moment, about how, oh, he's considering his future. Well, I think that was already being considered, right? Solskjaer's never been a massive fan of Lukaku, from what I've heard, and would prefer a pacier front line of kind of Rashford and Martial, and possibly Jadon Sancho.
So you're essentially looking at, I mean, so, you know, Mata goes, Herrera goes.
Yeah.
You're essentially looking at between maybe 6 and 12 players that are safe, and the rest are kind of, you know, up for grabs.
You probably can't get rid of. In fact, it'd be an interesting piece to do here. Sanchez, who is going to take that off their hands? First of all, is he willingly going to take a lower wage offer from anywhere?
No chance.
I mean, and who it's... So, like, and this is the problem, because that it's actually amazing now, that whole.
Sorry, I just got a phone call. But don't worry, the pod continues. It was a friend of ours.
That's Sanchez. At the time, you could understand the rationale, and yet he has now become the single greatest illustration of how dysfunctional and badly run a club United are. Because I think this has been something that's been raised a lot the past few days, where the value of kind of city sporting structure, and why you appoint people like Chicky Bagiristein in technical roles rather than people like Mike Phelan. Because when it came down to a negotiation like that, not only do City have the contacts and know-how, but they also know the value of a player. So when the kind of the Sanchez price started kind of spiraling, they kind of, no, this isn't worth it. Whereas United went, oh, this looks good. This is good PR. It's yet another short-term move.
Exactly. The short-term hit. Yeah. The short-term feel-good factor. Yeah. That's what comes from hiring Solskjaer. They get a really short-term PR hit from that. Everybody loves Ole. Let's capitalise on that. And then 6 weeks down the line, it's astonishing how many of the wrong decisions they've taken at the wrong time.
As regards the manager alone, or the managers alone, with Moyes initially, there was the needless six-year contract, precisely as some sort of kind of sop to the whole notion of longevity and basically that whole idea of the long term, without necessarily deserving the long term.
And insurance against what happened.
Yeah, exactly. And then even the fact they give Mourinho a new contract when there were already problems, and a few months before they refused to back him in the summer. Not unreasonably, I'd say, in that case. But
Moyes is still under contract, right? This is the last year of Moyes' contract.
Yeah. It's always interesting hearing Miguel sum it up like that, because it is such a damning record of bad decision after bad decision going back to coming up to 6 years now since Woodward's been there. I mean, often we like to kind of compare Manchester United to a massive company, like people like to say, oh, they're just like Shell or whatever, but it's hard to imagine, it's hard to see that much underperformance could lead to continued service in the top job in another massive company.
At
it's incredible.
Functional companies. There is, you know, obviously there's a board, but there is more than one decision maker. There is a pool of decision makers, and there is kind of a synergy of ideas rather than United, which it feels like is being run on the whims and feelings of one guy, essentially.
Yeah, and a guy who people who know him say is very kind of reason-based and intelligent in every other area of his job. But when it comes to football, too emotion-based, too driven by short-term headlines, too driven by the mood of the crowd, which comes back to these short-term decisions. And I heard a story about how from corporate circles, how when he got the job initially from Gill, he was advised to kind of immediately bring in football people, and while that was on his mind, he, you know, fancied running it this way essentially until it got to the point in the last 2 years where the need for a football structure has become, you know, imperative.
Woodward clearly fancies himself as a kind of footballing visionary, like, doesn't he? It's like a, I mean, the phrase, which I can't remember whether I wrote it in a piece or whether I just wrote it in a text or something, it's a super tanker being driven like a speedboat.
Yeah. Have you seen that clip going around from one of those out of context Twitter accounts, which is Woodward, you know, you're seeing Schweinsteiger in the team will send a shiver down the spine.
Yeah, I retweeted that earlier. I think Miguel probably did too. If you can find it, check it out. It's amazing. It's funny how what you say about how Woodward's a football visionary. The guy's had like 8 different visions since he's been in the job. Like that in itself should be disqualifying. And that, I mean, this is the segue. That is the contrast with City. Yeah. It's the fact that City have had...
Like, I'm going to trample all of your segue here.
Go on.
It's like the John Cleese character in The Life of Brian, who goes like, you are the Messiah, and I know because I followed a few.
Yeah, exactly. That is exactly it. But yeah. Then, you know, the contrast with City is so obvious because City have been built, like what City have now, they have been building it for years, like literally for 10 years. You know, they got what, Cheeky and Soriano in 2012.
Yeah.
That's when they made their first approach to Guardiola. They then got Guardiola basically in the bag in 2015. He joined in 2016. Yeah. Like everything has been there for a very long time with the same people and the same ideas.
There's a line I used in that piece, but City went and, all right, fair enough, they're kind of the most lavish football project in history, but why that's been so ominous for the rest of football is because they spend that money intelligently. And one of those was basically incorporating what everyone says is the apple of football and basically Barcelona's brains trust.
Yeah, that is kind of the nub of the whole City project, is that I think football could have survived City just being rich, like being like Abramovich, as in having lots of money and change their mind all the time and doing different things year on year. But football can't really survive City being really rich and really smart.
Yeah.
That's kind of what has killed football, has been City having all this money and also being good with it. It's when Wenger famously described them as having petrol and ideas. Mm. That's what he was getting at, is that like he's never come across anyone who was both rich and clever at the same time.
Yeah, completely.
Where do you think City, how do you feel about City going into that game on Wednesday and what they're going to do?
I think Saturday showed that the midweek game definitely affected them. And that would be a worry, except for the fact they got through it. And the fact they got through it was crucial. I think that will leave a bit of a mental release for Wednesday. And I think it's going to be one of those... I remember talking... I used to do Stephen Hunt's column, and he was going on one time. When a team's in a bad run, what will happen is actually the first 20 minutes of games will actually be quite impressive from them because they overcompensate. And then eventually, unless they get an early goal, or even if they do sometimes, the reality of the team's problems start to manifest themselves on a pitch. And I think that's what we could see on Wednesday, where United go all out.
Do you have any stats on City's performance early on in games recently?
Actually, would you believe this has been a feature of my Twitter
really?
Recently?
Yeah. Bloody hell.
But I was actually talking about from the United side. So okay. I think United are going to go, because United are ones off form, I think United are going to go at City really strong from the start and then have gradually...
Like against Barcelona, which was, they played 10 sumptuous minutes at the Nou Camp. Yeah. I mean, I can see a path to United winning that game. It's not, you know, I don't think it's what's going to happen, but I can see it happening.
I know what you mean.
Can you unpack that? Can you say what it is?
Yeah, I mean, I think if City's recent run has almost entirely been built on breaking games open early, and if City don't score that, was it third minute goal against Spurs or seventh minute, something like that?
Fourth
minute. That game is totally different. And even with a 1-0 lead against Spurs, it was incredibly nervy and it was incredibly tense. And playing away from home at Old Trafford, if they don't get the early, if they have to chase the game in the second half, that kind of adds its own quantum of, well, let's call it panic, because if they don't if they don't win that game, the title's gone.
That is a problem. But the way I think United is just so... It would take one of those rare nights where United have that kind of strange defiance about them, where players kind of play beyond themselves. Like it can occasionally happen in football, but even if United go ahead, and even if there's an element of panic from City, I think if City just go about playing their game, I know this is a cliche, but I think it's all the truer in this case. If City just go about playing their game, I think they'll gradually unravel the massive flaws in that United team.
Would United fans want Mourinho in charge. If United fans could get Mourinho in charge for this one game, I think you know that's the sort of performance.
Except for the fact that probably most of them want City to win the title.
Well, yeah, exactly. But I mean, but that's something obviously you know we should probably come to at some point. But I think that's the sort of tactical display that will win the game. They're not going to set about City and take them apart in the first 20 minutes. City are, I think, kind of too smart for that.
But I did think City looked vulnerable in the first half on Saturday. Spurs could have scored 3 or 4 goals in the first half. And it was basically only like the luck of finishing that meant that Spurs got those 2 early goals in the Champions League game last Wednesday, but didn't score any goals on Saturday. Like Son got in a few times, and the City defence did look a bit ropey. Like Edison had to come and make some saves. I'm not sure what that tells us about Wednesday though, because I was thinking about this earlier. Like United don't have anyone as good as Son. Like Rashford isn't as good as Son.
No,
United don't have anyone as good as Eriksen.
But if Rashford and Martial can sort of, you know, get some space on the counter attack and they actually get a few openings, and yeah, one of them goes in, and then what happens is City's fullbacks are then kind of wary of the threat. And that kind of blunts their attacking threat as well. And if United, I mean, I expect kind of United to line up quite narrow, like with not sort of letting Silva and Bernardo getting in those the little pockets in the channels that they like to operate in. So if they keep it tight in what you know you might call a Mourinho masterclass fashion, there's always the chance of burning a goal on the break. I don't think it'll happen. I think ultimately, individual errors more than anything, like one-on-one battles, that they're just going to lose too many of those, I think, for them to win that game. But that's how they would do it if they are going to do it.
Yeah, I wonder if Pep might play Leroy Sané, who's a player who we've talked about this before. He's gone off a bit in the last few years.
He hasn't started
a big game since the Liverpool win in early January, where of course he scored the winner, but that was like 4 months ago, and since then he's only been wheeled out for like meaningless games like Schalke second leg or Newport County or Swansea City.
What do you think that is, actually?
Well, I think it's a few things. One is Pep thinks he gives the ball away too much and thinks that Sterling, Aguero and Bernardo Silva is like a more consistent front three, also a bit more efficient. I think he's also had some issues with Sane's application off the pitch, not least his personal life, his contract row with City, which is ongoing, in which Sane's mother is said to be a big factor. So clearly, like, there is a bit of an issue there. It's like Sané is too good not to play most games.
Yeah,
you can, like, Mahrez being on the bench, fine. Gabriel Jesus being on the bench, fine. But Sané is one of the most talented players in the world of his age.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really have someone that good who isn't playing most of the games. But I kind of feel like, given that United will probably attack a fair bit tomorrow, given that their defence is pretty weak, is pretty slow, and like able to be beaten by fast players in behind, I wonder whether it might be a game for Sané. But of course, if he does play Sané, then that means he'd have to play Bernardo Silva back in the midfield three, and I wonder whether he'd be reluctant to do that just because he's been so good in the front three where he's been recently.
Yeah,
and it's amazing that one other decision that he has to make, and this sounds ridiculous, is Phil Foden or David Silva.
Silva's been a bit muted lately, though, hasn't he?
I think he just looks a bit tired, to be honest. Yeah. This has been his worst season for City. He struggles, I think, with quite intense games. He's better when it's slow, and he's a great guy for when you're 2-0 up and you're trying to see it out.
Mm.
But he's not really a good guy when it's all kicking off. He has struggled a bit recently, whereas Foden obviously came in and was pretty good, as Johnny wrote about the other day. And with Kevin De Bruyne injured again, he injured a hamstring, we think, in the game on Saturday, and he's missing, then I think the midfield will probably be Fernandinho, Gundogan, and then one other, which could as well be Foden.
It might as well be Foden. Yeah, I mean, I thought Foden had a great game on. We were both at the City Tottenham game on Saturday lunchtime, and I'd not seen a huge amount of him in the flesh. I'm not sure I'd even seen him in the flesh before, but his energy is incredible. I know, you know, that's kind of par for the course in a Pep midfield, but the way he pressed Tottenham's defenders, but all the way to the corner flag, essentially, the energy of the guy, and you know, some of his tackles were a little bit loose, I guess, and you know, there's a sort of an early yellow card in it for him, like some games, but I found it really impressive, and the way he takes the ball and moves it on kind of in the same movement, which is that's the kind of thing that Pep loves, like players that trap the ball and then look up and sit and see what they're doing. That's what most players are like, right? But taking the ball and sort of and moving it on in the same kind of action, which is what Sterling's so good at. That's what Foden's really good at as well.
Yeah, he has got he looks very un-English in the way that he receives the ball. Like, he's always on the half turn. He's got this kind of, like, I don't know how best to describe it, but he's got this kind of innate wiggliness when he gets the ball, and he can turn in either direction. He's always on the move, which makes him so good. I do think you're onto something with the tackles. Like, he, particularly, I wonder in the kind of away derby.
That was literally your point that you made, like, after the game to me.
Sorry.
I've stolen it and regurgitated back at you.
Short-term memory.
A feedback loop.
I wonder whether Old Trafford, like, United away derby sounds like the kind of game where, you know, maybe he could mistime a tackle and get sent off, and then suddenly City be in a very difficult position.
Like Connor in Dream Team.
I actually haven't seen Dream
Team. You've never seen Dream Team?
I've never seen Dream Team.
Well, it's about, you know the premise, right? It's about Harchester United, Midlands Bay. And so Connor, look, the first couple of series, I think, focuses on the youth team. And Connor, who's the Northern Irish lad, I think, he gets his go in the first team. Frank Patchen? No, Ian Coates. Ian Coates gives him his debut in the first team. I think they're playing Arsenal. And, like, Ian Coates wants him to show that he's a man. He wants him to, like, don't get intimidated, get in their faces. I know you're young, they're going to try and intimidate you, but, you know, show them what you want. And then within about 90 seconds, he goes in for a two-footed tackle and gets sent off.
On Ian Wright,
yeah. And he misses the rest of the game. And also doesn't get his contract renewed at the end of the season.
Yeah, he also gave up on football, I remember. I was quite a fan of that for the first two series, but the third series, it was...
Was that pre-plane crash?
The plane crash was when it started to really go.
The plane crash was when it jumped the shark, I think.
I mean, we already had the situation with Snake.
Was it the end of the first series or the end of the second series?
The second series.
There was a sniper in the... spoiler alert, but...
well, it is 20 years
old. Years on. Right, so the chairman, Jerry Block, suspects... it was Michael Melia, who was in EastEnders in the 80s. He finds out that his wife, Linda Block, who now plays somebody in Coronation Street... And I think was also one of the she played one of the characters in Coupling that Jeff goes out with. Anyway, finds out that his wife is having an affair with the club's Argentinian striker
Luis Amor Rodriguez,
and pays a hitman on FA Cup final day to climb up into the old Wembley scoreboard, and take a sniper shot at them, and take one of them out with a sniper.
My favorite thing about that game was. That was 98-99, and so it was the year United were going for the treble.
Oh, yes.
So they're playing United in the final, but they use the charity shield from two seasons beforehand, which was Chelsea drawing with United 1-1. United won on penalties, and they used the same Mark Hughes goal twice, because they used to use real goals and kind of, you know,
CGI them, but like 90s Sky One CGI.
So Harchester won 2-1, and they used the same goal twice, but from different angles. And I think the commentary said a carbon copy of the first. I'm not sure if they described United as treble winners even in the next season, but I'd like to think that's true.
Harchester won that game 2-1. They ended up in the UEFA Cup, right?
Yeah. Then had the plane crash and all
then
that.
Then had the plane crash. I think I stopped watching.
You know, they recorded an episode in my local nightclub when Monday Bandili had to marry an Irish woman.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I actually think per capita, Dream Team was bigger in Ireland than the UK.
Yeah, that's true of a lot of programmes, actually. Probably this podcast, even.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Who would have thought from Manchester United to Harchester United?
Yeah. Who do you think is the most... Actually, you know what? Let's move on. Should we move on?
Should we give predictions for tomorrow's game?
I was actually going to move back to Harchester United to ask another question about Dream Team, but in the last second, I've changed my mind.
No, go on.
What do you think there is scope for a similar, like, fictional football story? Do you think that if I was... Because I basically... The reason I ask is I got an email earlier saying that Netflix are making... Like, Julian Fellowes has written a drama about the invention of football in Victorian England.
Which is going to go down, like, really well around the world. Like, this idea that England invented football.
But what about... Like, fictional football is, like, one of the great untouched things in the world. In the market, right? Like, there never is good fictional football.
The problem with fictionalized sport is that if you try and base it on action on the pitch, it can't work because it always has to come down to a last minute winner, which feels a cliche. And ultimately can't match the authentic emotion of the real thing. So I think fictional football works best when they almost completely ignore what's... I actually think the Damned United did this really well, where they barely there was only a few clips of the
book or
matches,
the film,
the film,
right.
And the film kind of concentrated on actually the whole dynamics of what happens off the pitch, and kind of, and I suppose, like, and actually something else that did that quite well was Moneyball, because it does it, because that film isn't really about baseball, it's about how much you commit, it's about commitment to an idea, and also secondly the temptation of, I mean, at the end of the film, he has to kind of, in real life, the offer from a bigger club. Whether you keep going with the smaller club, or take the jump.
Last year, I saw, I think maybe a few years ago, a really good play by Patrick Marber called "The Red Lion," about a corruption and greed in a non-league club. It's there are only three characters: the manager, the player, and the kit man. Mm-hmm. And it's all about how this kind of dream they'd have of like a sort of idealized non-league football environment is in fact as corrupt as, like, inverted commas, real football. And it was a fantastic play, but like you say, like you can never do live action. You can never do tackling and passing because no actors will be able to do it.
Yeah, I mean, there was a really big boom. This kind of stuff in the 80s and 90s. You had Jossie's Giants. You had Dream Team. Footballers Wise, Renford Rejects. He had Playing the Field, which was about women's, like a BBC One's about a women's team in the 90s. You also had Gordon Kennedy was in one for BBC One in the 90s. And it seemed like, you know, there was a huge boom in this kind of stuff. But what's happened in the last couple of decades, it's become harder and harder to confect. And I think part of the reason for that is that football has so nakedly sold itself as a kind of television product in its own right.
Right, right, right.
The football is itself like primetime entertainment in the way that maybe it wasn't 20 or 30 years ago. And, you know, maybe that's why it's becoming harder and harder to make something that's make-believe football, because the real thing also feels sort of so staged.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think that... Yeah. It's almost like squeezed out the space that might exist for fictional TV football.
So, I guess where you go dramatically is you know, the boardroom or the personality behind it.
But that's, it's about the human emotion then, because the actual sporting emotion is just no matter what you do with it, it always feels manufactured and can't compare to the authentic, because any emotion based on supporting your club or whatever is going to be much deeper than the investment in a character in a program. So that is one of the flaws that kind of actually trying to, you know, capture on-pitch drama has as well.
So one of the things I like about the David Peace books is that they don't have to...
Yeah.
Is that they manage to turn the kind of true football story into a...
Yeah.
Emotionally investing, novelistic... I mean, what framework?
The Damned United, it's really about personal obsession and a grudge.
And so's the Shankly one, whose title I've completely forgotten.
I found it more difficult to read.
Yeah, it's a bit of a slog, but I do feel like he conveys like an idea of what that... his version of Shankly does shine through, basically.
Yeah,
And obviously, the repetitive style is boring, but that's for a reason. It's to illustrate that point, and I think that it does kind of grind that into your brain.
It was also how Shankly spoke as well, I suppose, that kind of oratory.
Cool. I think we're done with this segment. Should we go back to the game? Sorry.
I quite enjoyed that little segue into...
you don't get that on any of the other podcasts. So what are we going to talk about now? This is not me like...
Should we talk about the strange fan dynamics of tomorrow?
That is a good topic.
I thought this was a perfect segue to it, because we were talking about the passions and emotions involved in the game, and I think there's a really interesting kind of drama to be made about this title race, because, you know, in many ways for United fans it's kind of like the prisoner's dilemma or some other kind of psychological game, where can you possibly root for your biggest rivals? Can you lay down in front of your second biggest rivals in order to prevent your biggest rivals from winning what they want most of all?
It's like the reverse of, you know, I've forgotten what it's called, but when people say you've got to kill one of your two children, it's like the opposite of that. It's two
selfish
people
choice.
It's two people that you hate, and one of them has to be glorious.
Yeah.
And how do you choose which awful thing to happen, which awful person you want to win? It does seem like most, like basically 99% of United fans, or maybe there's even unanimity amongst Manchester United fans that they want City to win the title.
I said this on Twitter earlier and got a bit of backlash, although it seems to be a bit of a split. I mean, people claim that there's a big thing, if you want United to lose any given game, you are not a true fan. But then then someone else responded to that sort of thing saying, most Manchester locals want United to lose tomorrow because it's, you know, obviously the rivalry with Liverpool is bigger. But like, it's interesting. I think this tomorrow, it's going to be a mind-bending evening for basically three sets of fans. So obviously we're discussing United here, who have this dilemma of if they beat City, they almost certainly hand the title to the club they have the biggest rival with over anyone else. Added to that, the ongoing competition over who has the most league titles. It could be 2019 then.
Oh, yeah.
Liverpool then have the dilemma of they actually have to support United in a game. And in City is deeper. It's not as overt, but ultimately they have this bizarre situation where the club that they most define themselves against are the ones rooting for them.
Yeah, like James Milner saying that he's going to be supporting United for the first time in his life. But like the quote here, he says, "But I won't be watching. It's a bit of a waste of energy, willing the ball in the other goal," and it's a nice way of. Nice way of describing football support there.
I was actually when I saw that quote last night, I was thinking the same. In terms of football player, is it genuinely how exhausting is it to invest yourself in a game like that? Is it better for them to just kind of, you know, take the night off, play Fortnite or whatever?
Yeah, like ask the Leicester players watching Tottenham against Chelsea a few years ago.
Yeah.
Like it must be an incredibly weird experience when you're used to being able to influence matters on the pitch and having a really kind of clear. Vision of what you want to want to do for yourself, and we focus on ourselves. What they always say, that you're essentially now totally invested in this other game featuring 22 players that you have no real kind of connection with.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think of the City side of that? In terms of like this, I mean, this is again the club that they're. I mean, it's still despite the club they most define themselves against, and now they have this weird dynamic where
it's weird because I think it will be. I don't think it will affect City that much. But I think it would have done in the past, in the sense that City performances in derbies used to be driven largely by like adrenaline, overperformance, passion, for want of a better word. And there were lots of derbies where City would basically play out of their skin and then get a few lucky bounces and win, particularly in the sort of early 2000s, right up until the 2008 takeover. Whereas increasingly City have got better and better and better at United, that they can win these games without having, you know, without these kind of special circumstances. And now they're going to be playing a derby that's basically going to be passionless, I think. Certainly in the stands, if not on the pitch.
It'd be weird.
A game where they won't be facing the same hostile atmosphere. They won't be facing the same underdog status. But I think... like Pep was saying earlier in his press conference, he said Old Trafford is not a scary place to go anymore.
Just on that, I was watching Martin Tyler's Sky Sports archives last night, where they showed all of the recent, actually most of the Premier League derbies at Old Trafford, and City seem to have won the majority of the last decade, basically. In fact, if they this will be three wins in a row, won't it? If they go, because they in Pep's first season they won 2-1. When the first meeting between Mourinho and De Bruyne, or Mourinho and
last year they won 2-1 as well.
Last year they won 2-1. In fact, that was the game that actually won the title really last year, because propelled that winning run and basically kind of killed off United's challenge. And I've seen this a bit from United fans that we're due a win both in terms of at home against City and also the double side of them. They just can't go seven defeats in nine and another big defeat kind of after Barca Everton. But I don't buy into that. I think they very much can lose. Yeah.
I don't think that's how it works, is it?
No.
I mean, can we talk, like, are we talking sort of 6-1 levels of, you know, superiority here?
I don't see why not.
I think
it easily could be.
Yeah. There's a much bigger difference between the teams, obviously, than there was in that 6-1 game.
I remember, I wasn't out there, but you before the Brazil-Germany semi-final, like the 7-1, you said, like, I think Brazil are going to get absolutely splattered here.
Thank you, yeah.
Yeah.
I told you, McKenna, that.
Yeah.
You tweeted it as well.
Yeah, I tweeted at you, McKenna, actually.
Yeah. It's one of your greatest predictions. I know it felt intuitive in hindsight, but it's still a pretty big thing to say at the time. Like, I mean, my one was a few years ago. Do you remember when Arsenal beat Reading 7-5 in the League Cup?
I think you left our Christmas party early to go to that, didn't you?
Yeah.
When they were 4-1 down, I think I said, I think, Arsenal might sneak this, and tweeted it.
Okay, so what are we going for in terms of predictions? We're going I'm afraid, I hate to say it, comfortable Manchester City win.
5-0 Man City. I'm actually partly saying that because that means United would lose 3-0, 4-0, now 5-0 in the last three games. That's a bit of an exaggeration, but it's possible.
I think 1 or 2-0 City. I think it will be a tight game. I think City will have enough, but you know, if they get a couple of early goals, the floodgates could open. But I think United still just it'll be a totally different game from the Everton game. Dynamic, you know, the dynamic will be different, yeah, and the tactics will be different. And I think United will show a little bit more backbone than they've shown maybe recently.
I mean, a lot of people have, in the build-up to this game, United fans who do want them to lose have been talking about just throwing the kids, play the U team. But there's actually an argument that's for the better of the team. If he throws in players like, you know, Greenwood, it could be... Yeah.
And of course, United have, in a sense, a bigger game in the sense of it being winnable against Chelsea on Sunday. Yeah. Like, there's an argument that says United should take their eggs out of the Wednesday night basket and put them in the Chelsea basket.
Yeah.
And in doing so, they would increase their chances of getting top four.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Which I think is still alive for as long as Arsenal keep being as inconsistent as they are. Okay, we've been talking for 40 minutes, so I think we're probably going to wrap it up there. But
Have you had enough at home? Have you had enough? Is that enough podcast for you? That's a yes.
Thank you very much for listening, everyone. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Miguel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
And we will be back in your ears next week. Bye.
This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.